an old girlfriend had once dealt to, and had the guy make equally discreet inquiries and found that the potential murder two investigation of the botched burglary had been taken over.
190.
Pache the loud howls of a certain remorseless Revere ADA by something federal the adult stenographer called Nonspecific Services Bureau, whereupon the case vanished from any sort of investigative scene the stenographer could make inquiries about, though quiet rumor had it that current suspicions were being directed at certain shadowy, knucko political bodies all the way up in Quebec, far north of the Enfield, Massachusetts, where Gately had been cringing his way to nightly AA meetings with his fingers in his mouth. Most of the cases Gately had had pending, his PD had gotten closed without finding.
191.
Contingent on Gately's entering long-term treatment and maintaining chemical abstinence and submitting to random urinalyses and making biweekly reparation payments out of the pathetic paychecks he earned, cleaning shit and sperm under Stavros Loboculos, and now also cooking and live-in staffing at Ennett House. The only issue not resolved on a blue file deferral was the business of driving with a DUI suspended license. In the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, this issue carries a mandatory 90-day bit, as in like the penalties written right into the statute. And the case's PD has been upfront with Gately about it's only a matter of the time of the wheel's slow judicial grind before some judge red files the issue, and the case, and Gately, has to do the bit at some place MCI minimum, like Concord or Deer Island. Gately isn't too hinked about 90 inside. At 24, he'd done 17 months at Billerica for assaulting two bouncers in a nightclub. It was more like he'd beaten the second bouncer bloody with the unconscious body of the first, and he knew quite well he could get by in a Commonwealth lockdown. He was too big to fuck, or fuck with, and not interested in fucking with anyone else. He did his time stand up and gave nobody any provoking cause. And when the first couple hard guys had come after him for his canteen cigarettes, he'd laughed it off with ferocious jolliness, and when they came back a second time, Gately beat them half to death in the corridor behind the weight room, where he could be sure plenty of other guys could hear it. And after that one incident was out of the way, he could simply get by and not get fucked with. Gately now was hinked only about the prospect of getting just one or two AA meetings a week in jail. The only meetings sober inmates get are when an area group comes in on an institutional commitment, which Gately's been on. When Demerol and Tolwyn and good old Weed are almost easier to get in jail than in the outside world. Gately cringed now only at the thought of the sergeant-at-arms, the distinguished-looking shepherd guy. Going back to ingesting substances had become his biggest fear. Even Gately can tell this is a major psychic turnaround. He tells the newer residents right up front that AA's somehow gotten him by the mental curlies. He'll now go to literally any lengths to stay clean. He'll tell them right out that he'd first come to Ennett House only to keep out of jail, and hadn't had much interest or hope about actually staying clean for any length of time, and he'd been up front with Pat Modassin about this during his application interview. The grim honesty about his disinterest and hopelessness was one reason Pat even let such a clearly bad news specimen into the house on nothing but a lukewarm referral from a PO up at the 5th District office in Peabody. Pat told Gately that grim honesty and hopelessness were the only things you need to start recovering from substance addiction, but that without these qualities you were totally up the creek. Desperation helped also, she said. Gately scratched at her dog's stomach and said he wasn't sure if he was desperate about anything except wanting to somehow stop getting in trouble for things he usually afterward couldn't even remember he did them. The dog trembled and shuddered, and its eyes rolled up, as Gately, who hadn't been told about Pat's thing about wanting her dogs petted, rubbed its scabby stomach. Pat had said, like, well, that was enough, that desire for the shitstorm to end.
192.
Gately said her dog sure did like having its stomach rubbed, and Pat explained that the dog was epileptic, and said that just a desire to stop blacking out was more than enough to start with. She pulled some Commonwealth substance abuse study in a black plastic binder off a long black plastic bookshelf filled with black plastic binders. It turned out Pat Monacian liked the color black. A lot. She was dressed, really kind of overdressed for a halfway house, in black leather pants and a black shirt of silk or something silky. Outside the bay window, a Green Line train was laboring up the first Enfield Hill in the late summer rain. The downhill view from the bay window over Pat's black lacquer or enamelish desk was like the only spectacular thing about Ennett House, which was otherwise a wicked awful dump. Pat made a sound against the binder with a svelte nail extension and said that, in this state study, right here, conducted in the year of the Tux Medicated Pad, over 60% of the inmates serving life sentences in hellish MCI Walpole, and not disputing that they'd done what they'd done to get in there, nevertheless had no memory of having done it, whatever got them in there. For life. None. Gately had to have her run it by him a couple times before he isolated her point. They'd been in blackouts. Pat said a blackout was where you continued to function, sometimes disastrously, but weren't aware later of what you did. It's like your mind wasn't in possession of your body. And it was usually brought on by alcohol, but could also be brought on by chronic use of other substances, synthetic narcotics among them. Gately said he couldn't recall ever having a real blackout, and Pat M. got it, but didn't laugh. The dog was heaving and quivering with its legs spronged out to all points of the compass and kind of spasming, and Gately didn't know whether to quit rubbing on it. To be honest, he didn't know what epilepsy was, but suspected Pat was not referring to the woman's leg shaver thing his totally alcoholic past girlfriend, Pamela Hoffman Jeep, used to scream in the bathroom when she used. Everything mental for Gately was kind of befogged and prone to misprision for well into his first year clean. Pat Monacian was both pretty and not. She was in maybe her late 30s. She'd supposedly been this young and pretty and wealthy socialite out on the Cape until her husband had divorced her for being a nearly full-blown alcoholic, which seemed like abandonment and didn't improve her subsequent drinking one jot. She'd been in and out of rehabs and halfway places in her 20s, but then it wasn't until she'd almost died from a stroke during the DTs 1 a.m. that she'd been able to surrender and come in with the requisite hopeless desperation, etc. Gately didn't wince when he heard about Pat's stroke because his mom hadn't had DTs or a classic stroke, but rather a cirrhotic hemorrhage that made her choke and deprived her brain of oxygen and had irreparably vegetabilized her brain. The two cases were totally like apart in his mind. Pat M. was never in any way a mother figure for Gately. Pat liked to smile and say, when residents pissed and moaned about their own addictions' losses during the weekly house community meeting, she'd nod and smile and say that for her, the stroke had been far and away the best thing that's ever happened to her because it enabled her to finally surrender. She'd come to Ennett House in an electric wheelchair at 32 and been unable to communicate except via, like, Morse code blinks or something for the first 6 months.
193.
But had even, without use of her arms, demonstrated a willingness to try and eat a rock when the founding guy who didn't even use his first name told her to, using her torso and neck to, like, chop downwardly at the rock and chipping both incisors. You can still see the caps at the corners. And had gotten sober and remarried a different and older South Shore, like, trillionaire with what sounded like psychotic kids, and but regained an unexpected amount of function, and had been working at the house ever since. The right side of her face was still pulled over in this sort of rictus, and her speech took Gately some getting used to. It sounded like she was still loaded all the time, a kind of over-enunciated slurring. The half of her face that wasn't rictusized was very pretty, and she had very long, pretty red hair, and a sexually credible body, even though her right arm had atrophied into a kind of semi-claw.
194.
And the right hand was strapped into this black plastic brace to keep its nail-extensioned fingers from curling into her palm. And Pat walked with a dignified but god-awful lurch, dragging a terribly thin right leg and black leather pants behind her like something hanging onto her that she was trying to get away from. During his residency, she'd gone personally with Gately on most of his bigger court dates, driving him up to the North Shore in the killer Aventura with its handicapped plates. She, because of the neurological right leg thing, literally had a lead foot and drove all the time like a maniac, and Gately had usually almost wet himself on Route 1. And she'd throw all Innit House's substantial respect and clout behind him with judges and boards until every issue that could be resolved without finding was blue-filed. Gately still couldn't figure out why all the personal extra attention and help. It was like he'd been Pat M.'s biggest favorite among the residents last year. She did have favorites and non-favorites. It was probably unavoidable. Annie Parrott and the counselors and house manager always had their particular favorites, too, so it all tended to work out square. About 4 months into his Innit House residency, the agonizing desire to ingest synthetic narcotics had been, mysteriously, magically, removed from Don Gately, just like the house staff and the crocodiles at the White Flag Group had said it would, if he pounded out the nightly meetings and stayed minimally open and willing to persistently ask some extremely vague higher power to remove it, the desire. They said to get creakily down on his mammoth knees in the AM every day and ask God as he understood him to remove the agonizing desire and to hit the old knees again at night before sack and thank this God-ish figure for the substanceless day just ended, if he got through it. They suggested he keep his shoes and keys under the bed to help him remember to get on his knees. The only times Gately had ever been on his knees before were to throw up or mate, or shunt a low-on-the-wall alarm, or if somebody got lucky during a beef and landed one near Gately's groin. He didn't have any God or Jesus Christ background, and the knee stuff seemed like the limpest kind of dickless pap, and he felt like a true hypocrite just going through the knee motions that he went through faithfully every AM and PM without fail, motivated by a desire to get loaded so horrible that he often found himself humbly praying for his head to just finally explode already and get it over with. Pat had said it didn't matter at this point what he thought or believed or even said. All that mattered was what he did. If he did the right things and kept doing them for long enough, what Gately thought and believed would, magically, change. Even what he said. She'd seen it happen again and again, and to some awfully unlikely candidates for change. She said it had happened to her. The left side of her face was very alive and kind. And Gately's counselor, an ex-coke and phone bunco guy whose left ear had been one of his losses, had hit Gately early on with the infamous Boston AA cake analogy. The grizzled Filipino had met with the resident Don G. once a week, driving Gately around Brighton Alston in aimless circles in a customized Subaru 4x4. Just like the ones Gately used to hotwire and promote to use for burgling. Eugenio Martinez had this eccentric thing where he maintained he could only be in touch with his own higher power when he was driving. Down near EWD's barge docks off the Alston Spur one night, he invited Gately to think of Boston AA as a box of Betty Crocker cake mix. Gately had smacked himself in the forehead at yet another limp, oblique Gene M. analogy, which Gene had already bludgeoned him with several insectile tropes for thinking about the disease. The counselor had let him vent spleen for a while, smoking as he crawled along behind land barges lined up to unload. He told Gately to just imagine, for a second, that he's holding a box of Betty Crocker cake mix, which represented Boston AA. The box came with directions on the side any 8-year-old could read. Gately said he was waiting for the mention of some kind of damn insect inside the cake mix. Gene M. said all Gately had to do was, for fuck's sake, give himself a break and relax and for once Shut up and just follow the directions on the side of the fucking box. It didn't matter one fuckola whether Gately, like, believed a cake would result, or whether he understood the, like, fucking baking chemistry of how a cake would result. If he just followed the motherfucking directions and had sense enough to get help from slightly more experienced bakers to keep from fucking the directions up, if he got confused somehow. But basically the point was, if he just followed the childish directions, a cake would result. He'd have his cake. The only thing Gately knew about cake was that the frosting was the best part. And he personally found Eugenio Martinez a smug and self-righteous prick. Plus, he'd always distrusted both Orientals and Spics, and Jean M. managed to seem like both. But he didn't screw out of the house, or quite do anything they could discharge him for, and he went to meetings nightly, and told the more or less truth. And he did the shoe-under-bed-knee thing every a.m. / p.m. 24/7. And he took the suggestion to join a group, and get rabidly active, and clean up ashtrays and go out speaking on commitments. He had nothing in the way of a godlike concept, and at that point maybe even less than nothing in terms of interest in the whole thing. He treated prayer like setting an oven temp according to a box's direction, thinking of it as talking to the ceiling was somehow preferable to imagining talking to nothing, and he found it embarrassing to get down on his knees in his underwear. And like the other guys in the room, he always pretended his sneakers were, like, way under the bed, and he had to stay down there a while to find them and get them out when he prayed. But he did it, and beseeched the ceiling and thanked the ceiling, and after maybe 5 months, Gately was riding the greenie at 0430 to go clean human turds out of the Shattuck shower, and all of a sudden realized that quite a few days had gone by since he'd even thought about Demerol or Tolwyn or even weed. Not just merely getting through those last few days. Substances hadn't even occurred to him. That is, the desire and compulsion had been removed. More weeks went by. A blur of commitments and meetings and Gasper smoke and cliches, and he still didn't feel anything like his old need to get high. He was, in a way, free. It was the first time he'd been out of this kind of mental cage since he was maybe 10. He couldn't believe it. He wasn't grateful so much as kind of suspicious about it, the removal. How could some kind of higher power he didn't even believe in magically let him out of the cage when Gately had been a total hypocrite in even asking something he didn't believe in to let him out of a cage he had like zero hope of ever being let out of? When he could only get himself on his knees for the prayers in the first place by pretending to look for his shoes. He couldn't for the goddamn life of him understand how this thing worked. This thing that was working. It drove him bats. At about 7 months, at the little Sunday beginners meeting, he actually cracked one of the Providence fake wood tabletops, beating his big square head against it.
195.
White flagger, ferocious Francis Gehaney, one of the most ancient and gnarled of the crocodiles, had a white crew cut and scally cap and suspenders over the flannel shirt that encased his gut, and an enormous cucumber-shaped red schnoz you could actually see whole arteries in the skin of, and brown stumpy teeth, an emphysema, and a portable little oxygen tank thing whose blue tube was held under the schnoz with white tape. And the very clear, bright eye whites that went along with the extremely low resting pulse rate of a guy with geologic amounts of sober AA time. Ferocious Francis G., whose mouth was never without a toothpick, and who had on his right forearm a faded martini glass and naked lady tattoo of Korean War vintage, who'd gotten sober under the Nixon administration, and who communicated in the obscene but antiquated epigrams the Crocs all used.
196.
FF had taken Gately out for eye-rattling amounts of coffee after the incident with the table and the head. He'd listened with a slight boredom of detached identification to Gately's complaint that there was no way something he didn't understand enough to even start to believe in was seriously going to be interested in helping save his ass, even if he, she, it did in some sense exist. Gately still doesn't quite know why it helped, but somehow it helped when ferocious Francis suggested that maybe anything minor league enough for Don Gately to understand probably wasn't going to be major league enough to save Gately's addled ass from the well-dressed sergeant-at-arms now, was it? That was months ago. Gately usually no longer much cares whether he understands or not. He does the knee and ceiling thing twice a day, and cleans shit, and listens to dreams, and stays active, and tells the truth to the Ennett House residents, and tries to help a couple of them if they approach him wanting help. And when ferocious Francis G. and the White Flaggers presented him on the September Sunday that marked his first year sober with a faultlessly baked and heavily frosted one-candle cake, Don Gately had cried in front of non-relatives for the first time in his life. He now denies that he actually did cry, saying something about candle fumes in his eye. But he did. Gately is an unlikely choice for Ennett House chef, having fed for most of the last 12 years on sub shop subs and corporate snack foods consumed amid some sort of motion. He is 188 centimeters and 128 kilograms, and had never once eaten broccoli or a pear until last year. Chef-wise, he offers up an exceptionless routine of boiled hot dogs, dense, damp meatloaf with little pieces of American cheese and half a box of cornflakes on top for texture, cream of chicken soup over spirochete-shaped noodles, ominously dark, leathery, shake-and-baked chicken legs, queasily underdone hamburgs, and hamburg sauce spaghetti, whose pasta he boils for almost an hour.
197.
None but the most street-hardened Ennett residents would ever hazard an open crack about the food, which appears nightly at the long dinner table still in the broad steaming pans it was cooked in, with Gately's big face hovering, lunarly, above it, flushed and beaded under the floppy chef's hat Annie Parrott had given him as a dark joke he hadn't got, his eyes full of anxiety and hopes for everyone's full enjoyment, basically looking like a nervous bride serving her first conjugal dish, except this bride's hands are the same size as the house's dinner plates and have jailhouse tats on them. And this bride seems to need no oven mitts as he sets down massive pans on the towels that have to be laid down to keep the plastic tabletop from searing. Any sort of culinary comments are always extremely oblique. Randy Lance, up at the northeast corner, likes to raise his can of tonic and say that Don's food is the kind of food that helps you really appreciate whatever you're drinking along with it. Jeffrey Day talks about what a refreshing change it is to leave a dinner table not feeling bloated. Wade McDade, a young hardcore flask alky from Ashland, Kentucky, and Dooney Glynn, who's still woozy and infirm from some horrendous workers' comp scam gone awry last year, and is constantly sickly and who's probably going to get discharged soon for losing his menial job at Brighton Fence and Wire, and not even pretending to look for another one, the two have this bit they do on spaghetti night where McDade comes into the living room right before chow and goes, "Some of that extra fine spaghetti tonight, Doonster." And Dooney Glynn goes, "Ooh, will it be all lovely and soft?" And McDade goes, "Leave your teeth at home, boy," in the voice of a Kentucky sheriff, leading Glynn to the table by the hand, as if Glynn were a damaged child. They take care to do the bit while Gately's still in the kitchen, tossing salad and worrying about course presentation. Though Tiny Yule never fails to thank Gately for the meal, and April Cordelieu is lavish in her praises, and Bert F. Smith always rolls his eyes with pleasure and makes yummy noises whenever he can get a fork to his mouth. Pre-dawn, the 1st of May, YDAU, outcropping northwest of Tucson, Arizona, USA, still. "Do you remember hearing," USOUS's Hugh Steeply said, "in your own country in the late, I think, BS-70s, of an experimental program, a biomedical experiment involving the idea of electroimplantations in the human brain?" Steeply, at the shelf's lip, turned to look. Marat merely looked back at him. Steeply said, No? Some sort of radical advance. Stereotaxy. Epilepsy treatment. They propose to implant tiny little hair-thin electrodes in the brain. Some leading Canadian neurologist, elders, something, at the time had hit on evidence that certain tiny little stimulations in certain brain areas could prevent a seizure, as in an epileptic seizure. They implant electrodes, hair-thin, just a few millivolts or Briggs electrodes. Beg pardon? Marat coughed slightly. Also the type used in pacemakers of the heart. Steeply felt his lip. I'm thinking I'm recalling a tentative bio-entry saying your father had had a pacemaker. Marat touched his own face absently. A plutonium 239 pack-off power. The Briggs electrode. The Kennebec DC circuit. I am recalling terms and instructions. Avoid all microwaving ovens and mini transmitters. Cremation for burial forbidden. This is because of plutonium 239. So, but you know of this whole program with epileptics? Experiments they thought could avoid ablative surgery for severe epilepsy? Marat said nothing and made what might be seen as slightly shaking the head. Steeply turned back to face the east with his hands clasped before his back, wishing to speak of it one way or another, Marat could tell. I can't remember if I read about it or heard a lecture or what. The implantation was a pretty inexact science. It was all experimental. A whole lot of electrodes had to be implanted in an incredibly small area in the temporal lobe to hope to find the nerve terminals that involved epileptic seizures. And it was trial and error, stimulating each electrode and checking the reaction. Temporal lobes of the brain, Marat said. What happened was that Olders and the Canadian neuroscientists happened to find, during all the trial and error, that firing certain electrodes in certain parts of the lobes gave the brain intense feelings of pleasure. Steeply looked back over his shoulder at Marat. I mean, we're talking about intense pleasure, Raimi. I'm remembering Olders called these little strips of stimulatable pleasure tissue P-terminals. P wishing to mean the pleasure. And that their location seemed maddeningly inexact and unpredictable, even within brains of the same species. A P-terminal turned out to be right up next to some other neuron whose stimulation would cause pain or hunger or God knows what. The human brain is very dense. It is the truth. The whole point is they weren't doing it on humans yet. It was regarded as radically experimental. They used animals and animal lobes. But soon the pleasure stimulation phenomenon was its own separate radical experiment, while the second-string neuron team stuck with the epileptic animals. Older, or Elder, some Anglo-Canadian name, headed the team to map these, what he called, quote, rivers of reward, the P-terminals in the lobes. Marat idly felt at the little pills of cotton in his windbreaker's cotton pockets, pleasantly nodding. An experimental program of Canada, you stated. I even remember the Brandon Psychiatric Center. Marat pretended to cough in the recognition of this. This is a mental hospital, the far north of Manitoba, forbidding wastelands, the center of nothing. Because they were theorizing that these, quote, rivers or terminals were also the brain's receptors for things like beta endorphins, L-dopa, Q-dopa, serotonin, all the various neurotransmitters of pleasure. The department of euphoria, so to speak, within the human brain? There was no hint or suggestion yet of dawn or light. But not humans yet, Steeply said. Older's earliest subjects were rats, and the results were apparently sobering. The Canadians found that if they rigged an auto-stimulation lever, the rat would press the lever to stimulate his P-terminal over and over, thousands of times an hour, over and over, ignoring food and female rats and heat, completely fixated on the lever stimulation, day and night, stopping only when the rat finally died of dehydration or simple fatigue. Marat said, not of the pleasure itself, however. I think dehydration. I'm fuzzy on just what the rat died of. Marat shrugged. But the envy of all experimental rats everywhere, these rats, I think. Then likewise implantations and levers for cats, dogs, swine, monkeys, primates, even a dolphin.
Up the evolving scale, beta menels for each. Each dead?
Eventually, Steeply said. Or else they had to be lobotomized. Because I remember, even if the pleasure electrode was removed, the stimulation lever removed, the subject would run around pressing anything that could be pressed or flipped, trying to get one more jolt.
The dolphin, probably. It swam about and did this, I think.
You seem amused by this, Raimi. This was totally a Canadian show, this little neuroelectric adventure.
I am amused while you make a way toward your point so slowly.
Because then eventually Elder and company, of course, wanted to try human subjects, to see whether the human lobe had P-terminals and so on. And because of the sobering consequences for the subject animals in the program, they couldn't legally use prisoners or patients. They had to try to secure volunteers.
Because of a risk, Marat said.
The whole thing was apparently a nightmare of Canadian legalities and statutes. Marat pursed the lips.
I have doubts in my mind. Ottawa could easily have asked your then CIA for, what is the term, persons of expendability from Southeast Asia or Negroes. The subjects expended for your inspiring USA's MK Ultra.
198.
Steeply elected ignoring this, rummaging in the purse. But what apparently happened was that somehow word of the P-terminal discovery and experiment had gotten out up in Manitoba. Some low-level worker at Brandon had broken security and leaked word.
Very little else to do in northern Manitoba besides leaking and gossiping.
And suddenly the neuro team at Brandon pull into work one day and find human volunteers lining up literally around the block outside the place. Able-bodied, and I should remember to recall mostly young Canadians, lining up and literally trampling each other in their desire to sign up as volunteers for P-terminal electrode implantation and stimulation.
In full knowledge of the rats and dolphins' death, from pressing the lever?
Marat's father had always assigned it to Raimi, his youngest, to go first inside some public restaurant or shop to check for the presence of a microwave or GC type of transmitter. Of special concerns were stores with instruments for thwarting a shoplifter, the shrieking instruments at doors. Steeply said, and of course this eagerness for implantation put a whole new disturbing spin on the study of human pleasure and behavior. And a whole new Brandon Hospital team was hastily assembled to study the psych profiles of all these people, willing to trample one another to undergo invasive brain surgery and foreign object implantation, to become some crazed rats. All just for the chance of this kind of pleasure. And the MMPIs, and Millens, and apperception tests on all these hordes of prospective volunteers. The hordes were told it was part of the screening. The scores came out fascinatingly, chillingly, average. Normal.
In other words, not any deviance.
Non-abnormal along every axis they could see. Just regular young people. Canadian young people.
Volunteering for fatal addiction to the electrical pleasure.
But Raimi, apparently the purest, most refined pleasure imaginable. The neural distillate of, say, orgasm, religious enlightenment, ecstatic drugs, shiatsu, a crackling fire on a winter night. The sum of all possible pleasures refined into pure current and deliverable at the flip of a handheld lever, thousands of times an hour, at will. Marat gave him a bland look. Steeply examined a cuticle. By free choice, of course. Marat assumed an expression that lampooned a dullard's hard thought.
Thus, but how long before these leaks and rumors of P-terminals reach the Ottawa of government and public weal? For Canada's government reacts with horror at the prospect of this.
Ho, ho, ho! And not just Ottawa, Steeply said. You can see the implications if a technology like Elder's really became available. I know Ottawa informed Turner, Bush, Casey, whoever it was at the time, and everyone at Langley bit their knuckle in horror.
The CIA chewed a hand?
Because surely you can see the implications for any industrialized, market-driven, high discretionary spending society.
But it would be illegalized, Marat said, noting to remember the various routines of movements Steeply made for keeping warm.
Stop with the babe in wood charade, Steeply said. There was still the prospect of an underground market exponentially more pernicious than narcotics or LSD. The electrode and lever technology looked expensive at the time, but it was easy to foresee enormous widespread demand bringing it down to where electrodes would be no more exotic than syringes.
But yes, but surgery. This would be a different matter to implant.
Plenty of surgeons were already willing to perform illegal procedures. Abortions, electric penile implants,
the MK-Ultra surgeries,
Steeply laughed without mirth, or off-the-record amputations for daring young train cultists, no? Marat blew just one nostril of his nose. This was the Quebecois way, one of the nostrils at a time. Marat's father's generation, they had used to bend and blow the one nostril out into the gutter in the street. Steeply said, picture millions of average, non-abnormal North Americans, all implanted with Briggs electrodes, all with electronic access to their own personal P-terminals, never leaving home, thumbing their personal stimulation levers over and over.
Lying upon their divans, ignoring females in rotting, having rivers of reward without earning reward.
Bug-eyed, drooling, moaning, trembling, incontinent, dehydrated, not working, not consuming, not interacting or taking part in community life, finally pitching forward from sheer, Marat said,
giving away their souls and lives for pitaminal stimulation, you are saying.
You can maybe see the analogy, Steeply said, over the shoulders to smile in a wry way. In Canada, my friend, this was. Marat made a very slight version of his rotary motion of impatience.
From the early 1970s of time, this never has come to be. There would have been no development of the happy patch.
We both went in, both our nations.
In secret.
Ottawa first cutting the Brandon program's funding, which Turner or Casey or whoever howled at. Our old CIA wanted the procedure developed and perfected, then classified. Military use or something.
Marat said, but the civilian guardians of the wheel of the public felt differently.
I think I'm remembering Carter was president. Both our combined nations made it a security priority, shutting it down. Our old NSA, your old C-7, with the RCMPs,
bright red jackets and hats with red brims, in the 1970s, still on horses.
Steeply held his mouth of the purse, half up to the faint lights of Tucson, peering for something.
I recall they went in directly. As in guns drawn, boomed the doors, dismantled the labs, mercy killed dolphins and goats. Olders disappeared somewhere.
Marat's slow circular gesture.
Your point finally is Canadians also. We would choose dying for this, the total pleasure of a passive goat.
Steeply turned, fiddling with an emery board.
But you don't see a more specific analogy with the entertainment?
Marat tongued the inside of his cheek.
You are saying the entertainment is somehow optical stimulation of the P-terminals? A way to bypass Briggs electrodes for orgasm and massage pleasures?
The dry rasp of the emery-ing a nail.
All I'm saying is analogy. A precedent in your own nation.
As our nation is the Quebec nation. Manitoba is...
I'm saying that if he could get past the blind desire for harm against the U.S., your Monsieur Fortier might be induced to see just what it is he's proposing to let out of the cage.
His training was such that he could emery without watching the procedure. For Steeply's most effective interviewing tactic was this long looking down into the face without emotion of any kind. For Marat felt more uncomfortable not knowing whether Steeply believed a thing than if Steeply's emotion of face showed he did not believe.
Then tonight, at the prospect of boiled hot dogs, the two newest residents had pulled the typically standard new resident Princess and P special food issue thing. The new today girl, Amy J, that just sits there on the vinyl couch, shaking like an aspen, and having people bring her coffee and light her gaspers, and with just short of a, like, helpless victim, please coddle sign hung around her neck, now claiming red dye number 4 gives her cluster migraines. Gately gives this girl, like, a week, tops, before she's a vapor trail back to the Xanax. She has that look.
199.
And the weirdly familiar but southernish-sounding girl, Joelle Van D, with the past-believing bod and the linen face announcing she was a vegetarian and would rather eat a bug than even get downwind of a boiled frank. And but in an incredible move, Pat M. has asked Gately, at like 1800 hours, to blast down to the Purity Supreme down in Alston and pick up some eggs and peppers so the two new delicate-tummied newcomers can make themselves quiche or whatever. To Gately's way of thinking, this looks like catering to just the sort of classic addict's claim of special uniqueness that it's supposed to be Pat's job to help break down. The Joel VD girl seems to have, like, inordinate immediate weight and pet status with Pat, who's already making noises about exempting the girl from the menial job requirement, and wants Gately to look for some kind of weird big red soda water tonic for the girl, who's apparently still dehydrated. It's sure a long way from making somebody chew feldspar. Gately has long since quit trying to figure Pat Montesian out. It's a weird weather evening, both thundering and spitting snow. Gately had finally become able to distinguish genuine thunder from the Enfield sounds of ATHSCME fans and EWD catapults, this after 9 months of wearing a Goodwill rain slicker every morning on the 0430 Green Line. One of the possible weak spots in Gately's AA recovery program of rigorous personal honesty is that once he's jammed himself into a black-as-water Aventura and watched the spoiler throb as he turns over the carnivorous engine, etc., he often finds himself taking a little bit less of a direct route to a given innit errand site than he probably could. If he had to come right down to the heart of the issue, he likes to cruise around town in Pat's car. He's able to minimize the suspicious time any particular bit of extra cruising adds to his errands by basically driving like a lunatic, ignoring lights, cutting people off, scoffing at one-ways, veering wildly in and out, making pedestrians drop things and lunge curbward, leaning on a horn that sounds more like an air raid siren. You'd think this would be judiciously insane in terms of not having a license and facing a no-license jail bit anyway. But the fact is that this sort of on-the-way-to-the-ER with a passenger in labor driving doesn't usually raise so much as an eyebrow among Boston's finest, since they have more than enough other stuff to attend to in these troubled times. And since everybody else in Metro Boston drives exactly the same sociopathic way, including the finest themselves, so that the only real risk Gately's running is to his own sense of rigorous personal honesty. One cliche he's found especially serviceable with regards to the Aventura issue is that recovery is about progress, not perfection. He likes to make a stately left onto Commonwealth and wait to get out of view of the house's bay window and then produce what he imagines is a rebel yell and open her up down the serpentine tree-lined boulevard of the avenue as it slithers through bleak parts of Brighton and Alston and past Boston University and toward the big triangular Citgo neon sign and the Back Bay. He passes the Unexamined Life Club, where he no longer goes, at 1800 hours, already throbbing with voices and bass under its ceaseless neon bottle, and then the great gray numbered towers of the Brighton Projects, where he definitely no longer goes. Scenery starts to blur and distend at 70 kilometers per hour. Commonwealth Avenue splits Enfield, Brighton, Alston, from the downscale north edge of Brookline on the right. He passes the meat-colored facades of anonymous Brookline tenements, Father and Son Market, a dumpster nest, Burger King's, Blanchard's Liquors, an Interlace outlet, a land barge alongside another dumpster nest, corner bars and clubs. Play It Again, Sam's, Harper's Ferry, Bunratty's, Ratskeller, Father's First 1 and 2. A CVS, two interlace outlets right next to each other. The Ellis the Rim Man sign. The Marty's Liquors that they rebuilt like ants the week after it burned down. He passes the hideous Riley's Roast Beef, where the Alston group gathers to pound coffee before commitments. The giant distant Sitgo signs like a triangular star to steer by. He's doing 75 kilometers down a straightaway, keeping abreast of an inbound Green Line train ramming downhill on the slightly raised track that splits Commonwealth's lanes into two and two. He likes to match a green train at 75 kilometers, all the way down Commonwealth's Integral V, to see how close he can cut beating it across the tracks at the Brighton Avenue split. It's a vestige. He'd admit it's like a dark vestige of his old, low self-esteem, suicidal thrill behaviors. He doesn't have a license, it's not his car, it's a priceless art object car, it's his boss's car, who he owes his life to and sort of maybe loves. He's on a vegetable run for shattered husks of newcomers just out of detox whose eyes are rolling around in their heads. Has anybody mentioned Gately's head is square? It's almost perfectly square, massive and boxy and mysticetously blunt. The head of somebody who looks like he likes to lower his head and charge. He used to let people open and close elevator doors on his head, break things across his head. The indestructible, in his childhood cognomen, referred to the head. His left ear looks a bit like a prize fighter's left ear. The head's nearly flat on top, so that his hair, long in back but with short Prince Valiant bangs in front, looks sort of like a carpet remnant somebody's tossed on the head and let slide slightly back but stay.
200.
Nobody that lives in these guano-spotted old brown buildings along Commonwealth, with bars on the low floor's windows, ever goes inside, it seems like.
201.
Even in thunder and little asterisks of snow, all kinds of olive Spanish and puke-white Irish are on every corner, bullshitting and trying to look like they're just out there waiting for something important and drinking out of tall boys wrapped tight in brown bags. A strange nod to discretion, the bags, wrapped so tight the outline of the cans can't be missed. A shore boy, Gately'd never used a paper bag around street corner cans. It's like a city thing. The Aventura can do 80 kilometers per hour in third gear. The engine never strains or whines. Just eventually starts to sound hostile. It's how you know to hurt your hip and shift. The Aventura's instrument panel looks more like the instrument panel of a military aircraft. Something's always blinking and indicating. One of the blinking lights is supposed to tell you when to shift. Pat has told him to ignore the panel. He loves to make the driver's side window go down and rest his left elbow on the jamb like a cabbie. He's caught behind a bus whose big square ass is in both lanes and he can't get around it in time to beat the train across the split, though. And the train crosses in front of the bus with the blast of its farty-sounding horn and what Gately sees as a kind of swagger to its jiggle on the street-level track. He can see people bouncing around inside the train, holding onto straps and bars. Below the split on Commonwealth, it's Boston University, Kenmore and Fenway, Berklee School of Music. The Sitgo signs still off in the distance ahead. You have to go a shocking long way to actually get to the big sign, which everybody says is hollow, and you can get up inside there and stick your head out in a pulsing neon sea, but nobody's ever personally been up in there. Arm out like a hack's arm, Gately blasts through BU country, as in backpack and personal stereo and designer fatigues country. Soft-faced boys with backpacks and high hard hair and seamless foreheads. Totally lineless, untroubled foreheads like cream cheese or ironed sheets. All the storefronts here are for clothes or TP cartridges or posters. Gately's had lines on his big forehead since he was about 12. It's here he especially likes making people throw their packages in the air and dive for the curb. BU girls, who look like they've eaten nothing but dairy products their whole lives. Girls who do step aerobics. Girls with good combed, long, clean hair. Non-addicted girls. The weird hopelessness at the heart of lust. Gately hasn't had sex in almost 2 years. At the end of the Demerol, he physically couldn't. Then, in Boston AA, they tell you not to. Not in your first year clean, if you want to be sure to hang in.
But they, like, omit to tell you that after that year's gone by, you're going to have forgotten how to even talk to a girl, except about surrender and denial and what it used to be like out there, in the cage.
Gately's never had sex sober yet, or danced, or held somebody's hand except to say, the Our Father, in a big circle. He's gone back to having wet dreams at age 29. Gately's found he can get away with smoking in the Aventura if he opens the passenger window, too, and makes sure no ashes go anywhere. The crosswind through the open car is brutal. He smokes menthols. He'd switched to menthols at 4 months clean because he couldn't stand them, and the only people he knew that smoked them were niggers, and he'd figured that if menthols were the only gaspers he let himself smoke, he'd be more likely to quit. And now, he can't stand anything but menthols, which Calvin T. says are even worse for you because they got little bits of asbestosy shit in the filter and whatnot. But Gately had been living in the little male live-in staffer's room down in the basement, by the audio payphone and tonic machines for like 2 months before it turned out the health guy came and inspected and said all the big pipes up in that room's ceiling were insulated in ancient asbestos that was coming apart and asbestosizing the room, and Gately had to move all his shit and the furniture out into the open basement, and guys in white suits with oxygen tanks went in and stripped everything off the pipes and went over the room with what smells like it was a flamethrower. Then hauled the decayed asbestos down to EWD in a welded drum with a skull on it. So Gately figures menthol gaspers are probably the least of his lung worries at this point.
You can get to the Staro 500 off Comm Ave below Kenmore via this long, twiny, overpass-shadowed road that cuts across the fens.
202.
Basically, the Staro 500 is an urban express route that runs along the bright blue chalk all the way along Cambridge's spine. The Charles is vivid even under gloomy, thundering skies. Gately has decided to buy the newcomer's omelet stuff at Bread and Circus in Inman Square, Cambridge. It will explain the delay and will be a subtle nonverbal stab at unique dietary requests in general. Bread and Circus is a socially hyper-responsible, overpriced grocery full of Cambridge Green Party granola crunchers, and everything's like microbiotic and fertilized only with organic, genuine llama shit, etc. The Aventura's low driver's seat and huge windshield afford your thinking man maybe a little more view of the sky than he'd like. The sky is low and gray and loose and seems to hang. There's something baggy about the sky. It's impossible to tell whether snow is actually falling or whether just a little snow that's already fallen is blowing around. To get to Inman Square, you veer over 3 lines to get off the Staro 500 on Prospect Street's Ramp of Death, and slalom between the sinkholes and go right, north, and take Prospect through Central Square, and all the way north through heavy ethnicity up almost into Somerville. Inman Square, too, is someplace Gately rarely goes anymore because it's in the Cambridge's little Lisbon, heavily Portuguese, which means also Brazilians, in the antiquated bell-bottoms and flare-colored leisure suits they've never let go of, and where there are disco-ized Brazilians, can cocaine and narcotics ever be far away? The district's Brazilians are another solid rationale for driving at excessive rates of speed for Gately. Plus, Gately's solidly pro-American, and north of Central Square's clot and snarl, Prospect Street's a copless straight shot through eerily alien lands. Billboards in Spanish. Plaster Madonnas in fenced-in front yards. Intricately laced grape arbors looking seized and clutched at now by networks of finger-thick, bare woody vines. Ads for lottery tickets in what isn't quite Spanish. All the houses gray. More bright plastic Madonnas and nunnish get-ups on peeling front porches. Stores and bodegas and low-suspension cars triple-parked. An all-out, full-cast creche-type scene hung from a second-floor balcony. Clotheslines hanging between houses. Gray houses in rows squished right up next to each other in long rows with tiny, toy-strewn yards. And tall, the houses, like being squished in from either side, distends them. My father had to walk unsteadily across the mattress in his white boots to get back to my side of the mattress and the bedroom behind me. On his way across, he stopped and felt speculatively at his jaw. His boots sunk deep in woodland floral cotton. He said, "Fuck it," again. And I remember not being clear about what he was referring to. Then my father turned and started unsteadily back the way he had come across the mattress, one hand against the wall for support. He instructed me to wait right there, in the hallway, for one moment, while he darted into the kitchen, at the other end of the hall, on a very brief errand. His steadying hand left four faint, smeared prints on the wall's white paint. My parents' bed's box spring, though also king-size and heavy, had just below its synthetic covering a wooden frame that gave the box spring structural integrity, and it didn't flop or alter its shape, and after another bit of difficulty for my father, who was too thick through the middle even with a professional girdle beneath his glad costume, after another bit of difficulty for my father squeezing with his end of the box spring through the bedroom doorway, we were able to get it into the hall and lean it vertically at something just over 70 degrees against the wall, where it stayed upright with no problem.
"That's the way she wants doing, Jim," my father said, clapping me on the back in exactly the ebullient way that had prompted me to have my mother buy an elastic, athletic cranial strap for my glasses. I had told my mother I needed the strap for tennis purposes, and she had not asked any questions. My father's hand was still on my back as we returned to the master bedroom.
"Right then,"
my father said. His mood was now elevated. There was a brief second of confusion at the doorway as each of us tried to step back to let the other through first. There was now nothing but the suspect frame left where the bed had been. There was something exoskeletal and frail-looking about the bed frame, a plain, low-ratio rectangle of black steel. At each corner of the rectangle was a caster. The caster's wheels had sunk into the pile carpet under the weight of the bed and my parents and were almost completely submerged in the carpet's fibers. Each of the frame's side had a narrow steel shelf welded at 90 degrees to its interior's base so that a single, rectangular, narrow shelf perpendicular to the frame's rectangle ran all around the frame's interior. This shelf was obviously there to support the bed's occupants and king-size box spring and mattress. My father seemed frozen in place. I cannot remember what my mother was doing. There seemed to be a long silent interval of my father looking closely at the exposed frame. The interval had the silence and stillness of dusty rooms immersed in sunlight. I briefly imagined every piece of furniture in the bedroom covered with sheets and the room unoccupied for years as the sun rose and crossed and fell outside the window, the room's daylight becoming staler and staler. I could hear two power lawnmowers of slightly different pitch from somewhere down our subdivision street. The direct light through the master bedroom's window swam with rotating columns of raised dust. I remember it seemed the ideal moment for a sneeze. Dust lay thick on the frame and even hung from the frame's interior support shelf in little gray beards. It was impossible to see any bolts anywhere on the frame. My father blotted sweat and wet makeup from his forehead with the back of his sleeve, which was now dark orange with makeup.
Jesus, will you look at that mess?
He said. He looked at my mother.
Jesus.